this and other podcasts are available on the Gun Rights Radio Network, gunrightsradio.com. Podcasting freedom.
Hi, folks. Bob Main here with another episode of the Handgun World Show. Why do I carry a gun? Because I can't carry a cop. Thank you for tuning in to episode number 65. Fresh off of vacation, folks, I'm glad to be back. Let me tell you, took a road trip with the family, had a great time. Thank God, I even though I took my guns, didn't have to use them. That was good. And I tell you what, you know, it's good to get away. It's good to get away, do some thinking, do some reflecting. Went down to Florida for a while, enjoyed some beaches. There was no oil on the beaches. However, a few days after we left, it started washing up on the panhandle of Florida. We spent a couple of our days in the panhandle enjoying the beautiful beaches down there. Anyway, thanks for tuning in. This is a practical show. I am not a gunsmith or ex-law enforcement or ex-military or a combat trainer. I'm not going to get technical. Just going to keep it rooted in common sense. I'm a private guy. I'm a Yankee with a gun, born in New York City, raised in Wisconsin. Now I live in Dallas, Fort Worth. It is blistering hot, folks. I got to tell you, the weather is hot, and it's Saturday, the 26th of June. I didn't think I was going to get a chance to do another podcast until around the 1st of July, but here I am. I found the time, and I got a lot of things to say because I had a chance to do a lot of thinking during the vacation. So let me give you a synopsis of what's going to go on in this show. During the first half, I've got some listener feedback that I want to share with you on subjects like practicing pistols, what kind of pistols for action shooting. Somebody else emailed me about a little bit about politics, not much. Somebody else emailed me a reloading technique, in other words, performing reloads, which I thought was pretty good, and also got a numbskull and a notable award as well. I'll get into that. And then the second half, I'm going to talk about some of the differences between the performance shooting sports like IDPA, USPSA, and actual real combat training, because even though you know I'm a big fan of IDPA and USPSA, I will agree that it definitely can create some bad habits, and I want to talk about some of those bad habits. So as I drive around here in my car doing some errands after my vacation, I'm going to go ahead and share with you some of the thoughts that I have here on this show. Okay, let me take care of just a few announcements. I don't like to make this show real commercial, but there's a couple of things that you need to know. First of all, the website, handgunworld.com. If you want to email me directly, bob@handgunworld.com is probably the best way. Some of you have been sending me some emails. Send them over to bob@handgunworld.com. And don't forget about the Gun Rights Radio Network Forum. I've got a thread over there. Go to gunrightsradio.com, click the forum tab, become a member. Good people over there. I'm really enjoying that forum, so that's another good way for you to interact with me. I also want to say that on the 15th of July, I am going to start a raffle, a fundraising raffle. I've already got two prizes set up. I'm going to try to have at least four. Now, I'm going to keep it a surprise right now, but I've had a very good manufacturer donate a couple of really good products. You've all heard of this manufacturer. I'm going to keep them private for right now. I'm not going to say anything, not going to ruin it, but you're going to want at least one of what I'm going to raffle off, because it's going to be part of your overall concealed carry system. The reason I'm going to do this raffle is I want to raise some money for three causes. The first cause being the NRA. Folks, I'm a firm believer that even though we don't always agree with what the NRA does, they do a great job of trying to advance the cause of gun rights in the United States of America. And the other beneficiary of this raffle is going to be the Gun Rights Radio Network. Mark Vandenberg's got a great thing going here, bringing us all together and the forum and everything else that he's doing. And folks, it does nothing but help us preserve our gun rights. So I'm going to give back to the Gun Rights Radio Network. And so that's where a third of the money is going to go. And then the last third of the money is going to help support the Handgun World Show. Just recently got the bill for renewing the domain name and the hosting fees and things like that. Now, some of you have supported my show financially. Thank you, thank you, thank you. If you can find it in your heart to do that, I'd appreciate that. Once I start this raffle on the 15th, a third of those proceeds will go to help support the show. I'm just going to continue to improve it every way I can. All right? So, stay tuned for that. That's all I'm going to say about that. Stay tuned for it on the 15th. And let's go ahead. That concludes the announcements. So let's go ahead and get into some listener feedback. While I was on vacation, I got some really good emails from some of you. One of them comes from a guy named John. And he writes and he asks me an interesting question. He says that he has become involved in a local pistol league that's called the VIPL. Now, I love this name. Name of this pistol league is the VIPL. Very informal pistol league. I love it. He says, we shoot at 15 yards, both center fire and rim fire. He says, my question is, the guy that's in charge of the pistol league pretty much said, I need an accurized 1911. But he went on to say that a state cop friend of his really encouraged him to get an M&P. So his question to me is, can an M&P be modified for target shooting? What do you think? Do I need to get the accurized 1911, or can I get an M&P and modify it for target shooting? And he says, keep up the great podcasts, Ted. And he says that to me because he thinks I sound like Ted Nugent, which I don't. But anyway, I guess if you think I sound like Ted Nugent, that's okay. I'll take that as a compliment, I guess. I love the Nuge, though, don't you? Let me answer this guy's question. Sir, I do not think you need an accurized 1911. Now, before I start getting flamed and beat up by all of you 1911 owners out there, please don't take it as if I'm criticizing you if you own a 1911. It's a fine, fine handgun. Today's well-built 1911s are great defensive firearms. For this purpose, for this very informal pistol league, I don't think that you need an accurized 1911 if you're going to be shooting at 15 yards or less. I am guessing that the purpose of this league is to practice defensive pistol skills. And you know me, I value reliability more than accuracy any day. All modern pistols are accurate enough for their intended purposes. And there's some very reliable and accurate 1911 out there. But you don't need to get one. Yes, that M&P is a great gun. You can modify that M&P for target shooting. I wouldn't modify it much. You know me, I like to keep guns pretty much as unmodified as possible if I'm going to be carrying them. And one of the interesting questions that John asks me is, he says, you know, if I get an accurized 1911, I'm probably going to have to get another gun for defensive carry. You know, well, that's a personal choice, sir, but yeah, I see that a lot. People will play gun games and with an accurized 1911, and then they carry something else. I'm a firm believer if you're going to join a pistol league and get involved, shoot what you carry. Just my personal opinion, sir, but that's what I would say. Get the M&P. That's my vote. Yes, you can modify it. You know, when I was shooting the Texas IDPA Championship a couple weeks ago, if you remember, I said the first stage, Gordon Carroll was on my squad, and he ended up winning the whole thing in the stock service pistol division. He was shooting an M&P Pro. He had a Storm Lake barrel in it. He might have had a little bit of action job done to it, I'm sure. That's about all I saw that was modified in his gun. So if he can win the Texas State Championship with that M&P, get that. I'm assuming you're probably, sir, going to get that in .45. They also make real good .45s. The M&P gets my vote. Again, nothing against the 1911s, folks. So don't blast me too hard on that one, okay? Okay, let's move on. Another man by the name of Glenn emailed me, and he was making a comment about the podcast I recently did where I interviewed Steve, who is a liberal Democrat concealed carry instructor in Minnesota. And Glenn says, "Bob, I have a little trouble with someone who calls himself a liberal Democrat gun instructor. It seems like an oxymoron. To call yourself a Democrat is to align yourself to that party's platform. That platform, whether he acknowledges it or not, is gun control via ban and gun registration. It's the equivalent of someone saying they're anti-abortion and then voting for every pro-abortion candidate. It's a hard pill to swallow." Glenn, you know what? I agree with you. I have a tough time with the argument liberal and gun advocate, but I'll say this. Let's all remember that gun rights is not really, in my humble opinion, confined to just one political party and one political ideology. It just so happens that the conservatives and the Republicans have a far greater voting record, for the most part, overall, on gun rights than do the liberals. I am an ultra-conservative. I hope I don't lose listeners by saying that, okay? You've probably figured that out now after 64 episodes. I'm a conservative. But I also like to have a balanced show. I firmly believe all political opinions are welcome. And Glenn, while I agree with you, I just want all of us listening to this show to be very careful not to think that just because someone's a liberal that they automatically don't support gun rights. But yes, you make a good point. If you support the liberal platform and the Democrat platform, you know, you're pretty much supporting a large, large group of politicians that hate guns and want to take them away from us. So good point, Glenn. That's a tough one. Let's just not confine the gun rights debate just to one political party. That's a tough subject. I knew I was taking a risk when I did that podcast, but I like to keep my show as balanced as I can. Okay? Another guy writes me. Let's see. What's his name here? He signed his email Airborne Sheepdog, which I love that. I love that name, Airborne Sheepdog. Anyway, he writes to me, and he says, "I was listening to one of your shows the other day while I was working, and you commented on how you release the slide when you shoot your pistol and you run it dry. In other words, a slide lock reload." He says he's in law enforcement, been in law enforcement 15 years. He says, "We practice this on a regular basis, and I thought I may offer a suggestion." Now, this is a really good suggestion. I like what this guy says. He says, "Speed's our main advantage in my line of work, and we train to use the momentum of inserting a magazine into the magwell to assist with activating the slide release." I guess I never really thought of doing it that way before. He says, "This also ensures that you fully seat the mag." That's important, and will not have a failure to feed. As soon as your finger hits the mag release, move it to your slide release. Okay, I'll say that again. As soon as your finger hits the mag release, move it to your slide release. As you send the new mag home, all you have to do is hit the slide release and it will work. Using this method, we can engage 5 targets with 2 rounds each and reload in 5 seconds. It takes practice, but it will increase your speeds, and reloads are one of the easiest areas to increase or decrease your time. That I will agree with. I'll give you that, sir. That's true. Let me stop for a minute. I'm going to read the rest of this email, but let me say that that's a technique I'm going to practice that. I'm a little leery because, as most of you know, if you've been listening to me long enough, you know that I'm not a big fan of using that slide release under stress. It's a fine motor skill. I still firmly believe that under a great deal of stress, like a gunfight, fine motor skill is going to go out the window, so I'm going to continue to use the overhand tug method. And go back and listen to some of my other podcasts and jump on my YouTube channel at Handgun World Show on YouTube, and you'll see what I'm talking about with the overhand tug method of releasing the slide. Here's another good idea that Airborne Sheepdog mentioned in his email. He said, "The last thing I want to leave you with is a simple drill to assist with what happens when you lose your fine motor skills." Now, this really got my attention, folks. This really got my attention. What to do when you lose your fine motor skills. He said, "This is something to practice." Take your gun apart and lay it on the table, including your magazine. Mix the pile of pieces up so that they're scattered around. And then go do a couple minutes of continuous exercise to get your heart rate up. Like do some push-ups or sit-ups or running in place. And after you get your heart rate up, try to reassemble the gun and the magazine. If you have the availability to do this at a gun range, as soon as you reassemble your gun, after doing the exercises, of course, then try to shoot a rack of plates, a rack of steel plates at 10 yards, and see what happens. It's very difficult at first, but it's going to help you control your breathing, your heart rate, and your trigger press while under stress. That's a good idea. Think about that. Getting your heart rate up, you're going to be trying to cool down after getting that heart rate up. You're going to be distracted. That's kind of simulating being under stress. Try putting that gun back together. Try using the fine motor skills necessary to put your gun back together and then shoot a rack of steel plates. That would be a great exercise to try at the range. Anything you can do, I'm a firm believer, anything you can do to practice what is it like being under stress is going to help you in the long run in terms of your self-defense with a gun. So, good email from Airborne Sheepdog. Thank you very much. Now, the next email is a good one because this is going to lead me into what I call numbskulls and notables. You guys have probably have heard some of my other podcasts, some of my older ones. I used to do a segment called numbskulls and notables. Numbskulls, somebody just who's a real idiot and says something stupid, and I'm going to call them out on it. And a notable is the opposite, somebody that says something brilliant or very noteworthy. Well, I got one of those for you. Okay, Patrick sent me this. This is great. He gave me an excerpt from the Appalachian Trail Guide for Pennsylvania. I'll say that again. The Appalachian Trail Guide for the state of Pennsylvania. This is what they published. You ready for this? Listen to this. Crimes of violence, up to and including murder and rape, have taken place at various times over the years, and they can be more difficult to deal with because of the remoteness of most sections of the trail. Although telephones are rarely handy along the trail, if you can reach one, the 911 service is now in use throughout most of Pennsylvania. And this is what got me mad when I read this. The carrying of firearms is not recommended. The risk of accidental injuries or death far outweigh any self-defense that might result from arming oneself. Let me say that again. It says here in the Appalachian Trail Guide, Pennsylvania, the carrying of firearms is not recommended. The risk of accidental injuries or death far outweigh any self-defense that might result from arming oneself. That, for sure, gets the Handgun World Show, episode number 65, Numbskull Award. What a numbskull, stupid thing to say. Patrick, who sent this email in, he gets the Notable Award because I love his comment. I hate it when murder and rape are, quote, more difficult to deal with, end quote. That's true. I agree with you, Patrick. I hate it, too, when murder and rape are more difficult to deal with. Can you believe that crap? Oh, man, this just gets my blood boiling. And I actually got another numbskull for you. I'm going to go ahead and play an audio soundbite from Fox News. This was last year when the state of Indiana, when Bloomington, Indiana, started publishing in the newspaper the names of concealed carry holders. You know, when I took my Texas concealed carry renewal class about a month ago, the instructor reassured us that state of Texas is not going to release the names of concealed carry holders to the media. All right, but listen to this numbskull, Dennis Hennigan. Pretty sure that's his name. They're going to introduce him on this news clip. Dennis Hennigan from the Brady Campaign. And, of course, he lies and stretches the truth, just like Eric Shelton from the Handgun Podcast recently said, that the Brady Campaign lies. Yes, they do. I agree with you on that, Eric. And not only do they lie, but as you mentioned, they often omit facts just to skew public opinion their way. So listen to this bonehead. Now, there's going to be an interview here. Just listen to the bonehead from the Brady campaign. Listen to what he says. Here you go.
Gun owners in Indiana say they are being treated like sex offenders. Why? Well, because one of the local papers there, the Bloomington Herald Times, has posted this database of which private citizens own guns. The paper says the information is public record, but is it an invasion of privacy? We are joined right now by Caleb Giddings, a gun owner in the Bloomington area and a member of the NRA, and Dennis Hennigan, Vice President of Law and Policy at the Brady Campaign. He joins us from Washington, D.C. All right, Caleb, let's start with you. Why do you say that by the fact that this newspaper is printing information regarding who has carry permits in Indiana, that's treating gun owners like sex offenders?
Well, thanks for having me on. Initially, when the database was launched, they actually put it in the crime section of their website. So you could go online and, much like a registered sex offender database, search your city, your street, your zip code, or your county to find out how many people with handgun permits lived in your area.
Right.
And it's just like going to the sex offenders database and finding out how many registered sex offenders live around you.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, what do you think about this? I mean, if you're getting a carry permit to privately carry a gun legally, why should everybody who lives on your street know whether or not you actually carry a gun? Because apparently in Nashville, the newspaper there, the Commercial Appeal, they actually have that information on their website.
Well, as I understand it, it's information about whether you have a carry permit. It's not information about whether you are carrying a gun at any particular time.
Well, how many people get a carry permit? Dennis, how many people get a carry permit and don't carry a gun or don't have a gun?
Oh, quite a few, actually. Quite a few, actually.
Really?
But the point is that these newspapers across the country have actually performed a public service because they have gotten the names of people who have these carry permits, and then they have compared them to the criminal databases. And what we have found is that in these states that have these so-called shall-issue laws that basically liberalize the carrying of concealed weapons, take away police discretion over who can carry concealed, you find that many, many people have been given these permits, even though they have extensive criminal backgrounds and violent backgrounds. And sure enough, we have seen that people with concealed carry permits often commit very violent crimes. Just this year alone, we have had 6 multiple killings across the country by people with concealed carry permits.
Right. Dennis, Dennis, you're absolutely right. If somebody's got a record that would say this guy shouldn't have a gun or have a permit, that is a function of law enforcement, that person should not have gotten a gun. However, here you've got these newspapers just putting this information out on their websites for anybody to look at for whatever purpose. Caleb, what do you think about this? Caleb?
Well, obviously, it's a, you know, for us, it's a huge invasion of privacy. You know, you're looking at, especially in the case of the Commercial Appeal, you're looking at, you know, a database with names and addresses and people's personal information. So a woman who has gotten a handgun permit or a carry permit so that she could get a firearm to defend herself from an abusive boyfriend or is worried about stalking, now her information's out there so that person can find it. And obviously, that's a huge invasion of privacy, and it's a big safety risk.
Okay,
when you look at what's happened here in Indiana, when you look at what's happened here in Indiana, you have the Herald Times has essentially printed a roadmap for gang members if they want to pick and choose which neighborhoods to go to steal firearms from.
All right, Caleb, here is what that particular newspaper said. They issued a statement. Our purpose was to provide public information we believe people would be interested in. We have databases for property sellers and buyers, restaurants that have been inspected, public salaries, and more. We don't believe we are treating them like criminals. All right, Dennis, I'm going to give you the final word.
Well, again, in Indiana, the press has actually discovered that over 500 people who have been granted these concealed carry permits, and this is just in 2 counties in Indiana, mm-hmm. have criminal backgrounds. We cannot possibly know whether these permits are going to dangerous people until the press knows who the people are.
All right.
And the press has done a public service by doing this.
All right. Caleb Giddings and Dennis Hennigan, we thank you, gentlemen, for joining us on this lively debate this morning.
Thank you.
And you folks out in TV land, email us. What do you think about it? In the meantime, off we go to the green room. Allie and Brian.
Thanks, Sid.
Hey, up next.
All right, what a numbskull. Need I say more? You know, he fails to point out the statistic that more criminals commit crimes than concealed handgun license holders. Give me a flippin' break. Well, I guess that's the Brady campaign for you, huh? Okay, and finally, the last bit of listener feedback that I want to share with you, and then I'll cut to segment number two shortly. A listener sends in a message to me that says, Bob, on episode 50, which model of the SOG Vulcan knife did you review, the VL-01 or the VL-02? Really enjoying your podcast, very informative, and I like the passion you bring about guns, and thank you for throwing in a little bit of humor for good measure. Well, thank you for that email. A comedian I am not. I do the best I can to try to break this up and not make it quite so monotonous sometimes. The Vulcan knife that I have is the VL-01, the SOG Vulcan, about a 3.5-inch blade. Absolutely love this knife. It is indeed my everyday carry. In fact, while I was on vacation, two things never left my pocket. This SOG Vulcan knife and a pocket pistol. And most of the time I carried my Glock 19, there were a couple times I had to slide my pocket pistol in, especially when I'm wearing swim trunks. And of course, no, I did not dive into the ocean with the pocket pistol in my swim trunks. But I got to tell you, these little 380s really come in handy for concealed carrying, pocket carrying in swim trunks. Anyway, this SOG Vulcan knife is just fantastic. It's not spring-loaded, but yet it does not barely need any effort to open this thing. Great hard VG10 Japanese steel. Check out the YouTube channel. I do have an excellent review on this knife. So if you're looking for a good knife to carry, if you're a knife addict like me, you know, if you should be going to Knifeaholics Anonymous, I'll probably see you at the Knifeaholics Anonymous meeting coming up soon, because I just I'm addicted to these as I am firearms. And so with that said, that concludes segment number one. Let's take a quick break here. A little bit of music for you, 20 or 30 seconds or so, and then I'll be back on with segment number two. Thanks. Segment number two, I want to talk about the differences between IDPA USPSA competition and real life gunfight training or combative training. And I mentioned earlier in the show when I first opened up the podcast that sometimes you can develop some bad habits by competition shooting. And you know, that is so true. You got to be real careful of developing bad habits, because some of the stuff that you do to compete more effectively doesn't translate very well if you have to actually defend yourself with a gun. And there's a website that I frequent a lot. It's called warriortalk.com. Warriortalk.com. It's Gabe Suarez's forum. And Gabe Suarez, president of Suarez International, it's his forum. I've been on there, I think, a little over 3 years now. It's a wealth of knowledge. I highly recommend that you sign up and become a member of warriortalk.com. Chris Upchurch put a good post on there. He's an instructor at Suarez International. And the post was actually written by Harold Green, and I'll link to this post in the show notes. You'll be able to go to the show notes and just click directly to the link and read it. But I'm going to put some of this in my own words and paraphrase it for you. But he says that IDPA can be beneficial, giving you good trigger time and helping you with your gun manipulation, testing out your equipment, holsters, and so forth, and just, you know, building up some of the good safety skills. But that being said, he said it can also lead to the development of some bad habits. The key is to be able to recognize the bad habits so you can make a conscious effort to avoid them. And here's what Harold Green posted. Some interesting stuff for you to think about. While I was on vacation, you know, I had a chance to, you know, replay in my mind many times the Texas State IDPA Championship, where I didn't perform as well as I wanted to. But, you know, I'm thinking to myself, all right, what do I have to work on next? And where do I want to take my training now? And I think the next step that I want to take my training to is not necessarily to become the champion in my division that I compete in IDPA. As a matter of fact, I'm going to borrow something from a listener. A listener named Steve Z, who listens and comments a lot, sends me a lot of really good emails, puts some great posts on the forum. He is shooting USPSA and doing a one-year experiment shooting his Glock 19, his carry gun. I'm going to do the same. So thanks for that idea, Steve Z. You get the credit for it, not me, but I'm going to do the same thing. For the next year, from now until next June, I'm going to shoot my Glock 19 in IDPA and USPSA competition. I'm also going to take some good training classes. One of them is going to be a Suarez International class that I'm going to take this fall with my Glock 19. It's my primary carry gun. After all, shoot what you carry, get good at what you carry. So this post by Harold Green, when I read this while I was on vacation, really jumped out at me. So listen to this. Some bad habits when competition shooting. Number one, poor use of cover. And there's three ways that this happens. A lot of times you can expose yourself too much to the opposition. And it happens when a shooter steps out farther than what is needed from behind cover. And I see this a lot in competition shooting, and I'm guilty of it. Matter of fact, when I post those videos from the Texas State match, you'll see a couple times I did that. I stepped out too far away from the cover. Bad habit. Okay? If you expose yourself too long from behind cover, it happens often when you're shooting multiple threats and slicing the pie as they want you to do in IDPA. You may spend a long enough time neutralizing the first threat, but the problem is that there's multiple targets, and if there's multiple people, the bad guy's partners will be able to sight in on your muzzle blast and then take you out as you move around and try to engage them and try to shoot them. Okay, another bad habit that he points out competition shooters sometimes get into is re-exposure in the same place. This happens when you fired from around the edge of cover. Then you duck back behind cover to reload, or for some other reason. And, you know, in IDPA, they say you have to duck back behind cover to reload, and then you come back out in the same place. Okay, if you do that, if you duck behind cover, reload, come back out in the same place, your opponent has had time to align his sights on your last known position and be ready for you. So when you pop back out to take additional shots, guess what? He knows where you're coming. He's got his sights on you. Bang. Think about that. It's something I didn't think about until I read this article. Another bad habit. Participating in organized pistol matches starts to condition a lot of us to think that most walls are cover, when in actuality, they're really concealment. And I have talked about this before. Cover is something that will stop bullets. Concealment will not. Concealment just blocks your view, blocks the bad guy's view of you. Okay, think about it in your home. Most interior walls are made of sheetrock. Bullets are going to easily penetrate through the sheetrock. That's not cover. That's concealment. Most car doors are made of thin sheet metal. Bullets will penetrate them. In a lot of pistol matches, the scenarios presented specify both of these as hardcover, and really they're not. They're really just concealment. It conceals your view from the bad guy. Okay, another bad habit that competition shooting creates is a lot of people go out there and they use a match gun and equipment rather than your everyday concealed carry gun and equipment. And that's what I just talked about. You know, earlier I talked about that. Too often we see people out there using fancy, souped-up, accurized guns in holsters and magazine pouches that they just don't carry. Okay, and I'm a firm believer that if you practice with equipment that's a whole lot different than what you may have to save your life with, it might not be in your best interest. I agree with Harold Green on that article, that part of the article. Shoot what you carry. Shoot what you carry. And that's why I like this this one-year experiment that I'm excited about it. Shooting my Glock 19 for an entire year. Shooting my Glock 19 in competition and taking some training classes, some real combat force-on-force. One of the courses I'm going to take is close-range gunfighting by Suarez International. They've got one coming up in East Texas, which isn't a very far drive from my home soon, and I'll be likely taking that one. I think it comes up in August. I got to check that. In fact, I got to register for that pretty soon. Okay. Another bad habit that competition shooting sometimes teaches you is the use of the low ready position for weak hand shooting. Oftentimes, the match directors will include weak hand exercises to simulate a disabled dominant hand. And quite likely, if your dominant hand is disabled in a defensive encounter, in a self-defense situation, it'll occur before you have the chance to draw your gun. He's right about that. Think about it. Okay, if your strong hand is disabled, it's probably going to occur before you can get that gun out of your holster. So practicing from the low ready position doesn't always do you a whole lot of good. You're going to need to have some kind of a way to use your weak hand to draw your gun out of your holster so you can save your life. Okay, another bad habit that Harold Green talks about that sometimes we develop in competition shooting is getting in the habit of double tapping everything rather than just shooting it to eliminate the threat. Shoot till the threat stops is what you should be doing, not just double tapping and then moving on to the next target. Okay? And I've seen some things happen in IDPA matches. I've seen shooters double tap a target when they were supposed to shoot it three times. The reason they double tapped it is there's such habit of shooting all paper twice. Okay, because most stages in IDPA and USPSA, you're shooting every paper target twice. So people just get into the habit, shoot twice, move on, shoot twice, move on. Okay, double taps are done so often, a lot of people have gotten into the habit of doing that double tap and then trying to see if they've made some good hits or not. And then, oh, okay, all right, fine, I made some good hits, now I can move on to the next target. In a real life situation, a double tap might not take down the bad guy. And if this happens, that hesitation that you make, that double tap and then hesitate and then assess to see, all right, well, let's see, has he dropped? Is he done yet? That could cost you. It could cost you big time. Shoot until the threat quits becoming a threat. Remember that. And try to avoid the bad habit of just double tapping everything. Okay, another bad habit that I find myself doing sometimes in competition shooting is shooting for speed rather than correct technique and correct tactics. Timers sometimes make us focus on speed rather than proper shooting technique. In a high-stress situation, bad technique could cost you the ability to hit your target and could get you killed. Okay, don't worry about speed. Just make sure your techniques are sound. Make sure you're getting good hits. Here's another big one. This was really startling when I read this article. Okay, competition shooting sometimes conditions shooters to automatically unload their gun at the end of the stage rather than scan at the end of the string. What that means is before you unload that gun, do a scan. Okay, look around you. Make sure there's no more threats coming. Now, be real careful. I saw somebody scan one time, and all of a sudden he starts pointing his muzzle around all over the place. That's not safe. Don't do that. Okay, keep your muzzle pointed downrange. Turn your head left. Turn your head right. Scan left. Scan right. Look over your left shoulder. Look over your right shoulder. Make sure you scan. Make sure there's no more threats coming before you unload that gun. Too many times in competition shooting, oh, well, guess what? We're done with the string. All of a sudden, the range officer comes up and says, show me a safe and clear weapon. You show him a safe and clear weapon. He says, pull the trigger, hammer down, reholster, range is safe. Sometimes that builds a bad habit. Make sure there's no... So think about this as a real-life situation. In real life, are you going to show the range officer a safe and clear weapon and then reholster? I don't think so. Okay, another bad habit that Harold Green points out is competition shooting sometimes makes a shooter depend on the buzzer as a cue to start shooting. And isn't that the truth? In real life, no one's going to sound the buzzer and tell you when you need to start defending yourself. Okay, the cues you're going to get to start defending yourself are probably going to be a lot more subtle and a lot more unnoticed than a big beeper going off next to your ear. Start learning to watch for the cues. As we say, being in condition yellow, and then act on those cues when there's sufficient need. Don't wait for the range officer to hit the button. And, you know, unfortunately, that's a bad habit that competition shooting can teach us. Okay, now, here's another one that's controversial, but I'm in 100% agreement with it. Competition shooting, especially IDPA, starts to condition shooters to perform tactical reloads whenever reloading a partially loaded gun. Tactical reloads are great and everything, folks, okay? It's great practice, and I guess it's something that levels the playing field a little bit in competition. And they're okay at the right time and the right place, but I'm just still not a believer in them. Okay? There's going to be times when you're going to need to top off your gun, and you don't have time for a funky tactical reload. You just need to top the thing off, get more ammo into it, and keep on shooting and end the fight. Okay? If you tack reload, you could cost yourself too much time, and costing yourself time in a gunfight is hazardous to your health, folks. If you're in jeopardy of running out of ammo in your gun, just get more ammo in there as quick as possible and keep on fighting. That's my theory, and I agree with Mr. Green on that. Okay, so now I'm going to bring this to a close here in a minute, but there's a few things that Chris Upchurch added to Mr. Green's article. And I didn't cover everything, so you do need to go back and read the whole article. I just kind of covered some of them that I felt were good for purposes of this podcast. But something else that Chris adds to it is he says, another bad habit that competition shooting causes is it encourages shooters to crowd cover. Now, this is something I didn't think about either. It causes you to crowd cover. Crowd cover means standing close to the cover and sticking your gun out beyond it. Okay? Now, people do this because it's easier for the safety officer to judge whether you're following IDPA's rules on using cover. But sticking your gun out beyond cover telegraphs your position to the bad guy. Think about that. It does. And it sets you up for a gun grab. So that's a bad habit, is getting too close to that cover. You know, contact distance, I would say arm's length from cover is probably a little bit more than arm's length from cover is probably a good idea, cover or concealment. And last but not least, Chris also mentions that one of the bad habits it creates is competition shooting inflates shooters' confidence. Boy, isn't that the truth. You know, just when you think you're good, folks, remember, in a real-life situation, you're only going to be half as good. I would say probably sometimes even only a third of as good as you are at the range, especially in IDPA competition. To me, that's scary. To me, that means I need to train more and practice more. Okay, I wasn't very happy with my performance a couple weeks ago at the Texas State match. If I'm only going to be a third as effective in a real-life self-defense encounter, boy, I got some work to do before I can feel confident that I can save my life. Okay, a lot of IDPA stages involve shooters gunning down large numbers of cardboard opponents. Isn't that the truth? And if you've ever taken any force-on-force training, force-on-force training will prove to you that anytime there's a three-on-one encounter, it's going to be a very tough challenge. Even if you're a highly skilled shooter, a three-on-one, especially if three people are armed against you and you're just one, even a really, really skilled gunman's going to have a hard time with that. Now, not saying you shouldn't shoot IDPA. You know I'm a big fan of IDPA, especially if you're a new shooter. Okay? I shoot IDPA every chance I can get. And let me just make this recommendation as I close. Approach IDPA and USPSA and VIPL, as John emailed me. Very informal pistol league. Approach those as an opportunity to practice your skills. Okay? And practice your gun handling skills and your safety skills, and to test your equipment, like I was talking about. Testing your holsters, testing your sights, testing your magazines, your springs, your ammo, things like that. But don't automatically assume that you're trained for a gunfight just because you've graduated to the next step in competition shooting. And try this. Try some experiments. I've done this, and I've kind of raised some eyebrows at some matches before, but go to an IDPA match and don't shoot the stage the way that the director says you have to shoot it. Shoot it in a tactical way. Shoot it the way that you think you would have to shoot it to neutralize all the targets and to remove the threats, even if you get a procedural penalty or two. Practice on what you need to do to save your life. Use the cover the way you would do in a real fight, rather than just the minimum IDPA rules. Okay? Use a concealment garment, even if the stage doesn't mandate it. You know, I went to a USPSA match one time, and I did that. I kept my concealment vest on the whole time. Somebody was asking me why I was doing it. I said, well, because I carry with my gun concealed, so I want to practice that way. Kind of looked at me strange, like, well, what's wrong with you? I don't know why I got such a strange look. Okay? Do things like checking behind you at the end of the stage rather than just immediately unloading, as I talked about before. And, you know, as Chris Upchurch mentioned, one of the other important things is slow down when it's appropriate, like slicing the pie, and then speed up when it's appropriate, like shooting on the move. Speed up when you're shooting on the move. All right? Do you want to slow down when you're on the move? If you're shooting at bad guys that are trying to shoot back at you and harm you, do you want to go slow or do you want to go fast? Your score might suffer, your time, your accuracy might suffer a little bit, but practice speeding up and getting hits on targets. It could save your life. The typical pistol fight is going to be a one-stage event, not an eight-stage IDPA match. And the typical pistol fight is going to be one stage that's going to be won mostly on who develops the best position, who has the best accuracy, and who can stop the threat. Okay, it's probably not going to come down to who has the faster reload or the faster split. The one stage actual pistol fight is going to come down to who can deploy their gun the fastest and who can get hits on target and keep shooting accurately enough to end the fight. Plain and simple. Would you agree? I hope you do. And so with that, I'm going to go ahead and bring episode number 65 to a close. I do have some more info on this that I'll share with you at a later date. But folks, it's good to be back. And thank you for tuning in to episode number 65. If you have any comments, as you know, I am always welcome to comments. I'm always welcoming of them. Contact me in any way you can. Keep them coming. Keep the show suggestions coming, folks. And if you can help the show out financially, I would appreciate that very much. This is Bob Main. You've just listened to another episode of the Handgun World Show, episode number 65 to be exact. And why do I carry a gun? Because I can't carry a cop. Thanks for tuning in. Catch you next time. Bye-bye.